How would you describe typical American foods? Or rather, what flavors come to mind when you say American cuisine? Sarah Lohman argues there are 8 flavors that unite the American food landscape. And like any good culinary historian worth their salt, she uses food to explore what our past can tell us about the present. Sarah writes that the United States boasts a culturally and ethnically diverse population that makes for a continually changing culinary landscape. And American food is united by these 8 flavors. Get ready now. Black pepper, vanilla, curry powder, chili powder, soy sauce, garlic, MSG, and sriracha. In her book, 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine, she explores how these influential ingredients made their way to the American table. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Hello, it's so good to be here.
Yeah, and it's so good to explore food, which we all love or can't live without, with somebody who really knows what they're talking about. So first of all, American cuisine. I mean, you know, we're such a melting pot.
Yes.
How can you describe American cuisine? What is it?
I think that is really what drove me to write this book, because we are such a diverse nation, both because of our own individual ancestries, but also our geography, too, really affects what we're eating and what it tastes like. So I thought to myself, okay, but let's look at something like black pepper or vanilla. Why do you keep seeing that appear in everybody's pantry, whether their ancestors are English and they live in Maine, or whether their ancestors are from Mexico and they live in Southern California, right? So that's the question I wanted to answer.
All right. And when we think about these flavors, each one has a story. And that's the cool thing about your book, just taking each one of these fundamental flavors and telling its story, where it came from, who are the people behind that, what is the geographical reason for it, and how is it embraced today? So once again, we're going to look at black pepper, vanilla, curry powder, chili powder, soy sauce, garlic, MSG, and sriracha. Mm-hmm. We'll see how far we get on this, but black pepper, it's so basic, so fundamental. How did that become part of our national cuisine?
Yeah, that was exactly the question that I wanted to answer, because it's so common we don't think about it. Where is it? Right. What is it from? And it turns out that it was really sort of a post-Revolutionary War explosion of American commerce. That pre-Revolutionary War, we had to buy everything through England. And that was part of what, that's why we were dumping tea in the harbor. We were basically protesting that we had to buy from England and pay their taxes. So it was through England we were getting black pepper, and they were keeping secret where they were getting it from. And then finally it sort of leaked that black pepper came from Sumatra on the other side of the planet. And it was some really sort of brave and also, you know, again, capitalist people who wanted to make money, merchants out of Salem, Massachusetts, that launched the first boats to go to the other side of the world. And America ended up taking away the black pepper trade from England, honestly, because we were nice to the native peoples of Sumatra, paid a fair wage, weren't violent, treated them as equals. And then everyone said, well, we want to trade with the Americans, not with the British. And so there were millionaires made in the late 18th century on the black pepper trade in Massachusetts.
Because, you know, right now I happen to be out of pepper in my house.
Ah.
And I'm realizing, I mean, it's just very, it's kind of a crisis. I got to go shopping just for this pepper.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so necessary, but I think it's so kind of underappreciated. And it's fascinating to think that we actually went on treacherous, you know, very costly voyages to get away from that British middleman and have control of our own source of pepper.
Yeah, it's not a native plant. So we went a very, very long way to get it.
All right, let's talk about vanilla.
Okay, so actually speaking of, vanilla is a native plant. It comes from Central America, and sort of the best known vanilla growing regions are right along the Gulf Coast in the region of Pampantla in Mexico. So vanilla really relied on native pollinators, and people were smuggling it out of Mexico and planting it all around the equator. The plant would bloom. It's an orchid, but it wouldn't produce the vanilla bean, the fruit of that orchid, until there was a plant in Réunion that All right, so this was a enslaved island, a French colony. There was an enslaver who had a young slave, a boy, who was named Edmond Albias. So there is an enslaver en Réunion. He had an enslaved boy named Edmond Albias, but he really educated this young boy, especially in botany. And it's Edward Albias that figured out how to hand pollinate a vanilla orchid. And it is still the same method of pollination that's used around the planet today. So a really remarkable innovation by a young black man.
What a story.
Yeah.
Just a little, a teeny bopper black slave boy innovated something that had an impact that we're feeling today on something so fundamental to our cuisine.
Yes. And of course, you know, the sad end to that story is that he really never saw a dime from it. He was given his freedom, and the man who was his former master really advocated we should set up, you know, a monthly income for this guy. Like, he made us all rich. And everyone just said, nah, we're not going to do that. So at least now we are starting to remember his name and his incredible contribution to our
Edmond
food.
Albias.
Edmond
Next
Albias.
Time you have a vanilla ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Edmond Albias.
Think of him, definitely.
And we can toast to him with our ice cream cone.
Yes.
Wow. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're joined by culinary historian Sarah Lohman. She's compiled a history of 8 key ingredients to American cuisine in her book. It's called 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Her latest book is Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. You can find out more about Sarah's work at her website. It's sarahlohman.com, L-O-H-M-A-N. Well, this is just so interesting. Let's just carry on. Curry powder. I mean, that's something that it'd be hard to manage without. Where did it come from and what's its story? And it's really cool when there's a person involved in the actual story of these foods.
You know, and that's such an interesting one to me because we have American curry recipes from the 18th century, even before in one of the British cookbooks that was really common in early America, there's curry recipes in there. But if I'm going through that list of American flavors, that's the one where people would stop me and say, wait a minute, that's not American. Well, we've been making it for 300 years, so what does that say about our perception of what's American or not? Huh. And in that chapter, I really focus on a chef. His name was Ranji Smile, or that was one of his names, I should say. We don't really know what his real name was. And at other points, he went by Joe, or he even went by Prince at one point, too. He really was quite a character. He was an immigrant from modern-day Pakistan via London to New York City in 1899. He cooked at one of the finest restaurants in New York City and cooked an Indian menu, as it was called. And he eventually became this like touring chef celebrity that would cook these Indian meals all across the East Coast. But also, he was kind of a bad boy, and he was married at least 5 times. And so he would, like, news about him, I found it in articles as far west as, like, Iowa and Utah. So he really was this known name that now has been really largely erased. And he was really key to the introduction of really traditional Indian food to America.
And when was that, roughly what year?
He lived in America between 1899 and 1930. And in 1930, he got on a boat saying that he was going to go home. And that is the last we've heard of him. Not just me, but other scholars are continuing to dig to find out what the end of his story is. But he really dominated the early 20th century in America.
So we have curry powder, and then we have chili powder.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story with chili powder? And also, a lot of this might relate to pre-refrigeration days. I mean, you know, I get a sense that a lot of spices, we like them because they're spicy, but a long time ago, you had to eat a lot of food that was borderline and you wanted to mask the sourness or the staleness of it by spicing it up.
Oh, Rick, I'm so glad you said that, because that is actually a little bit of a common misconception, a myth that we sort of propagated, that you spice something to hide maybe off flavors from spoilage. But what's really happening is that something like chili peppers, a major ingredient in chili powder, they are extremely antimicrobial. They kill about 99.9% of bacteria, viruses, and funguses. And so when you add that to a food like chili, a very meat-heavy food, it can prevent spoilage, not hide it.
Okay, now that's a little bit of a hair splitting there, but it's fundamental. Yeah, thank you for straightening me out on that.
And so when you think about spicy food, it tends to come from the hottest parts of the world, whether we're talking about India or whether we're talking about Texas and Mexico, which is where chili and chili powder originated. So it really has preservative qualities.
And conversely, in Norway, you have no need for that. So you just stick your food on the back porch and it stays cool because it's like the world is a refrigerator.
Exactly. That's exactly it. But we also have this human love of spicy foods. When we eat spicy foods, it releases endorphins because it triggers the same receptors in our mouth that trigger when something is physically hot, like our cup of coffee is too hot. That is also being tripped when we have a really hot bowl of chili. So our brain says, we're in trouble. It releases good feeling chemicals. But then when we're okay, it's kind of like riding a roller coaster, like, ooh, maybe I want to do that again.
Man, this is fascinating. Sarah, let's talk about soy sauce, because I guess you can say we have a very diverse population, so soy sauce would make sense. But I think of that obviously more Asian than I think of it as American.
I was shocked to discover that the first soybean farm and soy sauce factory in America was actually established in the 18th century. And so we love soy sauce, which is, oh my gosh, it's a complicated story. Basically, we have soy sauce and fish sauce, which is coming from East Asia, but the same traders that went over there for spices love those sauces. And so really in England, they started creating sauces like them. Worcestershire sauce is a good example. That's sort of a British version of soy sauce. And so then British Americans really still love that salty, savory flavor.
Oh,
and so
Worcestershire is an example of that.
Yes.
But it's not really borrowed from Asia. It is just fundamentally English.
Well, the concept is Asian. So, you know, if we're talking fish sauce or soy sauce, the British didn't have those ingredients to make that same thing. So they started playing with other fermentables, other local varieties of fish to create something similar. We did that here. Actually, ketchup is sort of a descendant of soy sauce because it was Americans trying to replicate soy and fish sauce with tomatoes. And then Heinz sort of added a little more sugar and vinegar.
Yeah.
And that's how we got modern ketchup. So all these sauces are related. It just took a little while for soy to get here. And then, of course, as Asian populations increased in the mid-19th century through the late 20th century, then we see more. Now we have both, not just soy sauce, but fish sauce and shrimp sauce and all those really savory sauces.
We're tasting our way through the history of American cuisine right now on Travel with Rick Steves with Sarah Lohman. She's a culinary historian and an author who helps create public programs focused on food. Sarah's written the book, 8 Flavors, to look at the stories behind American cuisine. Her latest book is called Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. You can find links to Sarah's work with the show notes for this episode at ricksteves.com/radio. So we're just scratching the surface of the chapters, and one of my favorite chapters is also one of my favorite flavors, tastes, garlic. What would we be without garlic?
Yeah. I mean, and what's so crazy about that is, of course, garlic, you know, we see it used medically a lot in early America, but not in cuisine until the massive immigration from Italy and Sicily around the turn of the 20th century. And I should also give credit to the Eastern European Jewish immigrants, too, who also use garlic quite a bit.
Okay, so wait a minute. We used it before we realized it was fun as kind of a medicinal thing.
Yeah.
And then with the help of Italians, we realized, hey, garlic, let's celebrate it.
Yeah, and a little bit, honestly, World War I and II, because it's a big part of the cuisine of the south of France. Because early on, people didn't want to emulate Italian and Jewish immigrants. In fact, garlic became very much stereotyped as stinky and gross and associated with that idea of those new Americans who weren't very American yet. So it took us wanting to emulate French food for us to really start eating a lot of garlic. And then just time. By the 70s, you get Gilroy's Garlic Festival coming together. So now we're talking about the grandchildren of those original turn of the century immigrants. And so you can sort of come out as a garlic lover and it's more acceptable.
Can you imagine bullheaded, simple-minded, fear-based racism keeping you away from something as beautiful as garlic?
I mean, of course I can, because unfortunately Americans still do it today. You know, one of the sort of greatest traumas, or it's a more complicated thing, of the children of immigrants is if they bring in a lunchbox full of the foods that they love that their mom is making, you know, there's this fear of the other, their classmates going, ew, what is that? You know, we still yuck other people's yum. And a lot of times it's more about things being quote unquote foreign than things not tasting good. It's different. It didn't matter whether an individual kid liked it or not. There was this idea of like, well, this is not American. Yeah. It's different. Yeah. And so I hope that we're discarding a lot of those ideas because they're pretty silly and they just get into the way of us enjoying new foods and cultures.
Well, we have not had much problem with sriracha.
No, I mean, it's truly an American story. I think a lot of people think that is a sauce from Thailand or Vietnam. It is not. It was created by a refugee family from Vietnam. The creator's named David Tran. He and his family ended up in Boston in the early 1980s. His brother was in LA. He called his brother and said, do they have hot peppers there? His brother said, yes. Picked the family up, started making sriracha from ripe jalapeno peppers in 1982. They have never spent a dollar on advertising, and they have sold out all their bottles of sriracha every year. Usually they're sold out even before they're made.
Amazing. And what a success story. And that's sort of like the rough and tumble, beautiful thing about the free market.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's good, if it's there, it's going to prosper. I was fascinated, Sarah, to see MSG, monosodium glutamate, on the list. Tell us about that, because it gets kind of a bad rap.
It does. And, you know, I really wanted to dive into it to combat that prejudice, because certainly we associate it, I think, largely with Chinese food and that it's bad for you. And that's sort of like, again, that food-based racism, that has connections back to the 19th century when Chinese immigrants were stereotyped as chopping up rats and cats in their food. And that's just the modern sort of version of it. It's silly, right? But at the same time that we were targeting, you know, a poor family-run Chinese food restaurant, MSG was being used by the tens of thousands of tons in American processed food and fast food brands, and still is. There is no proof. It's one of the most studied ingredients in American food that it is bad for you at all. But like anything, salt, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, you have to use it in moderation, right? That's the bottom line. So it adds a delicious, savory taste to foods. And again, we've seen an increased immigration since 1965 from Southeast Asia and Asia. And so now we're seeing it as more of an accepted and common ingredient. For a lot of East Asian families, MSG sits on the table with salt and pepper.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's got a marketing problem just based on its name. They should think of some kind of curry powder. That's a nice name. Soy sauce, sriracha.
Well, there's
MSG.
Accent. There are brand names. There's Accent. There's Kitchen Bouquet. I assume probably has it,
Kitchen
too.
Kitchen Bouquet. Okay,
right?
There you go.
So you just got to think of, like, better marketing. But, of course, Ajinomoto is the biggest brand internationally that produces MSG. They were actually the first Japanese manufacturing plant in America before cars or computers. Ajinomoto landed in the upper Midwest.
Sarah Lohman offers a culinary history of America in her book, Eight Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. She's also written Endangered Eating, America's Vanishing Foods. She offers recipes with her newsletter at sarahlohman.com. Sarah, you wrote that you've got great pride in American food. And I'm wondering, that's a beautiful thing, to have pride in our food. Why, and where do you think we're heading as a cuisine?
I mean, especially because I think American food is much maligned as all hot dogs and hamburgers, both by people from outside this country and even Americans. We don't recognize the incredible cuisine we have here. And I think when it comes to American food, diversity is our strength. When it comes to America, like, that is what makes us so special. We can travel the world when it comes to food and culture without ever leaving the boundaries of our country. Although you should, too, and get out there and see the world. But, like, I love that we are so different, and that makes us such a wonderful place to be.
So to embrace the diversity that we are as a country, and that includes the food as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your work with Eight Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Best wishes, Sarah.
Thank you, Rick. Oh, mazzy dotes and dozy dotes and little lambsy divey, a kiddly divey too, wouldn't you?
A kiddly divey too, wouldn't you? Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Casimir Hall, and Donna Bardsley. You can find links to our guests and listen to a podcast version of the show or search the archives. It's all at ricksteves.com/radio.